Introducing the panelists, we have at the very end, Rochelle Riley, who's a columnist for the Detroit Free Press and book editor slash contributor to the book The Burden, which is here, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. Next to her, we have Rachel Neuer, who's a freelance journalist and author of Poached, Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. And most of you heard that Rachel won last night the Beat Reporting Award, SCJ's Beat Reporting Award. Yeah, congratulations on that. We have Lisa Gardner, who goes by LS Gardner in print, but we can call her Lisa. She is the author of Tales from an Uncertain World, What Other Assorted Disasters Can Teach Us About Climate Change. And going down, we have Will Potter, who is an investigative journalist and also the Senior Academic Innovation Fellow at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And then finally, Anna Clark, freelance journalist and the author of The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. So lots of just totally timely tomes here. And just trends with books. Economically, books seem to be right now a real bright spot in journalism. I talked to both my agent, David McCormick, last week, and my editor, Eamon Dolan, and they both said next year looks great for serious nonfiction, the kind of things that people in this room would be most likely to do. They did say the trend does seem to be toward fewer titles and higher advances, so that means the bar is a little bit higher, but if you get over it, things are more easy. So interestingly, e-books, which everyone thought were predicted to dominate the trade book industry, are not doing well. They've had a terrible the last year. Those are way down, but audiobooks are way up over the previous year. So what we want to talk about today is how do you go about getting a piece of that? And we're going to try to please the crowd here. So a lot of this will be driven by your questions. And I just want to do a quick survey. These discussion points are the one, just if you're interested in one of these five or two of these five or whatever, raise your hand. You can vote more than once. But shaping an idea and constructing a winning proposal, sort of the beginning of the process. Okay, some interest in that. Working with agents and editors. Okay. And we get into the thick of it, carving out time and the space to actually write a book. It's a tight race here. Marketing and promotion. Okay. And then finally, spinning your book off to film or periodicals or other media. Okay, great. There's interest in just about everything. Let's start, I suppose, at the beginning. Did anybody have a sort of eureka moment that where you said, yeah, this thing I'm thinking about has got to be a book? And if you did, was it different than any other eureka moments that didn't turn out to be books in the end? Because I have a lot of eureka moments. They don't turn out to be books.
I'm happy to, is this on? I'm happy to take that one.
We're good, we got you.
Oh, thank you. It wasn't so much a eureka moment about how to do the book. That came almost immediately after, but 3 Septembers ago, a columnist for the Pittsburgh paper, Jack Kelly, wrote a piece about how black people needed to get over slavery and that black people were better off than had they stayed in Africa, which let me know two things, that Jack didn't know any black people and that he'd never been to Africa. And I decided I needed to address it, but I said, well, columnist code, you First Amendment, you can say whatever you want in your column. You can write whatever you want, even if you're wrong. So I didn't want to write a column refuting it. So I wrote a Facebook post just about, this misunderstanding about slavery. And the outpouring just to that post was so great that I said, oh, well, I think I'm going to do something bigger with that. But then I thought, I don't want to write a whole book myself because that's just one person railing against the machine again. So I decided to create a chorus of voices, and that's how it turned into a book, because, you know, everybody I called said yes. My first call was to my friend Leonard Pitts, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for Miami, and he was working on his book, and he put it down and said, okay, I'll write something about how slavery, the vestiges of slavery persist. And then I called Nicole Hannah Jones, my friend and fellow Tar Heel, and said, okay, I'm doing this. And she was dead in the middle of her book, which is based in Detroit. And she put it down and said, okay, I'll write the foreword, but I have to write it really fast because I'm on deadline. And I called Alelia Bundles, the great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker, and she said yes. And it went down the list, and I got 23 people and 23 essays, and that's when I realized, well, that's enough for a book. That's how I got started.
Did you reach out to an agent or an editor at that point at Wayne State University Press, or did they come to you and find out that you had something in the works?
Surprisingly enough, the blessing for me is that I have a pretty popular column, so I just called up the head of Wayne State University Press and invited her to tea, and she brought her acquisitions editor, and I said, this is what I'm doing, and they said, we'll take it. I know it won't work like that ever again, but for that day, that was pretty fantastic.
No, most people seem to have to go out and get it and work for it. I actually got very lucky, too. I did a story for Popular Science magazine, and it just went crazy viral. So within a week, I was getting calls from editors on the East Coast and producers on the West Coast, and I had agents that got them battling each other. So I got really lucky, and I think a lot of it had to do with just this concept that you could explain in one sentence. The 14-year-old boy becomes youngest person on Earth to build a working nuclear fusion reactor. So it seemed to kind of, you know, sort of catch fire, and I don't know if I'll ever get that lucky again with a book. I get the feeling most of us have to, you know, go through the grind. I still have to do a proposal, of course, and pitch it, but there was a lot of, thirst for it when I was getting it together. Who had to work very hard in pitching their book and had multiple rejections? You did, Rachel? Let's hear about that.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Yes. Great. I had the opposite experience. When I graduated from J school, well, I went into journalism knowing that I did want to write this book. And so immediately I pulled together a proposal, had some mentors look it over, and began pitching it out to agents and editors. And of those who actually replied, there was a resounding no, because everyone said the subject was too depressing. No one's going to want to read 300 pages about wildlife being killed. So I figured, okay, the professionals must know what they're talking about. It's a bad idea. And I shelved it. And the only reason this book is here today is because I'm sure a lot of people know Dan Fagan. His agent went on a vacation to Africa, to Kenya, and her eyes were kind of open to this crisis, and she came back saying, we have to find someone to write this book, and he put us in touch. That's how it happened.
Now, I think, Lisa, you did not have an agent, right?
I did not. I wouldn't recommend it. Is this on? Who can hear me in the back? Yay, okay. I didn't. Rockstar? Okay, it's a rock star mic.
Nice
ice cream
too.
Cone, rock star. So I did not have an agent, and I did work with an agent sort of early on in the project. I'm the type of person who I think the world can be divided into people who have too many ideas and think they're all related, and people who dive so deeply into a very small idea they can't see it's related to anything else. And so those are probably end members of a spectrum, and I lie on the it's all related kind of end. And so I was working with an agent to create a book proposal, and she was like, this is way too broad. This is what, you know, she wanted me to focus in, and specifically what she wanted me to focus in on was disaster, because people die and it's calamitous and everyone wants to read about that, and she knew she could sell it. And it helped solidify my idea that this is the exact opposite of what I wanted to write a book about. I'd been helping people understand climate change for about 10 years, and I saw them completely freaking out or feeling completely paralyzed and not able to do anything. And I was like, well, that, you know, this is really not helpful if we have more of these narratives of humans versus nature, and nature always wins. And I couldn't go that route, and we stopped working together. This was way before I had like a really concise idea for the book. It was very broad, and so that's why she sort of latched on to this one thing, disaster, you know, that she felt she could sell. And I heard back from her after Hurricane Sandy, and she was like, you know, I kind of get it now. She had experienced this flooding and this drama and all that, and she was like, you know, people still had to eat dinner. You know, like, they're, you still go on, even in the midst of a disaster. And it really helped me understand, even though we were not well-suited for each other, it helped me understand that that's, you know, that's something I wanted to convey, and I needed to figure out how to get there. I wasn't there yet, and I wound up working with a university press and an acquisitions editor there that really was helpful in helping me get rid of all the distracting side ideas and focusing in to help tell that story.
And yet you say you wish you would have had an agent to make the deal.
I mean, I do, because I'm horrible at self-advocating. And so I think that if I'd had an agent that really saw the project I wanted to do, then if it was a very good fit and an agent that saw what I wanted to do and felt like she could sell that idea, I think that would have been the perfect scenario. And I didn't get that choice, but if anyone has an agent out there who they think for next book, I think I'd go the agent route.
Well, that's actually a good segue, because a lot of people ask me, how do you get an agent? How do you find an agent? And I think for most of us, we find them through our literary friends who have books. But Anna, how did you find yours?
It's really connected to my book origin story. I'm a freelance journalist in Detroit, and I write for a number of different publications about a lot of different kinds of things, especially things that relate to, you know, urban policy and how cities are made, how they're unmade. I've been really interested in shrinking cities, including Detroit, but not just. And when the Flint water crisis was escalating, I began doing some articles about that, though, to be clear, way later than I should have been, so I feel kind of very culpable, and part of that, you know, the people who should have been there sooner. But in fall of 2015, I started doing some articles about it, and as after the new year, when this, like, crisis was just skyrocketing into the, you know, global consciousness, an agent reached out and asked if I would be interested in, you know, who had read my articles and had, if I was interested in doing a book. And that was, like, I had this, like, rush of excitement, but I also was, like, very cautious, because what I was afraid of is that, you know, what I didn't want to do was to, you know, participate in some kind of slapdash, take advantage of the spotlight, you know, rush to press kind of thing, you know? Like, if I was going to do a book, I wanted to do something that was much more substantial, because one thing that was very clear to me is that with a crisis like this, like, first of all, like, telling it iteratively, like, one article at a time was extremely challenging, you know, like, it was very difficult to, like, bring all the threads together, and in some ways it contributed to a lot of confusion and obscurity, and also that I felt very clear that this crisis didn't start with the switch in April of 2014, it went back decades, you know, it was this longer story, kind of tied in with a lot of reporting I'd been doing for a long time about, like, why are some cities, you know, gutted. You know, why do we concentrate our poverty? How does this played out with our history of segregation? All that stuff. I mean, I needed a lot more space in like 1,200 words, you know? But happily that agent was like completely on board with that, like very much saw that and was what she wanted too. I didn't have to persuade her, she knew it. And so she like coached, she gave me this lovely reading list. That's the first time I read Dan Fagan. She helped me put together a proposal that she ended up putting out there. And the whole thing, like from that first agent call to it being finished, was like in 6 weeks. It happened super fast. And I think one of the threads I'm getting out of some of this is like sometimes it's sort of, the story meets its moment, you know, and part of our job as writers is not just to work hard and keep doing our reporting and, you know, envisioning what we can do with a long form piece, but also sort of recognizing and being ready for a moment when it does come.
So not everybody can just drop everything and concentrate just on the book. Even if you don't have a full-time job, you typically have to clear a lot of things off your table before you can get to, you know, writing full-time on a book. And Will, I think you actually were working full-time the entire time you wrote your book, right? You want to tell us a little bit about how you carved out time for it?
I don't know if I'm the best example of how to do this, because there's certainly a lot of lessons learned along the way and a lot of health and kind of mental toll. But yeah, I had a full-time, what I was calling as my day job and approaching this as my real job. And I think that approach mentally to undertaking a project like this when you have so much else on the plate is really essential. And, you know, part of it was motivated by my book is about how environmentalists became labeled by the FBI as the number one domestic terrorism threat. And so the book is part, a little bit of memoir about being visited by the FBI and threatened to put on a domestic terrorist list following people in courtrooms, but also it's kind of old school investigative journalism using open records requests and leaked documents and things like that. And part of the reason I worked full-time is that all the conversations with agents and some of the bigger houses, it was either too controversial or kind of echoing what we've already heard about, well, we're not sure if people care that much or if it's that topical. And ironically, all this stuff now is kind of the, in my mind, the playbook for what's being used against Black Lives Matter activists, water keepers, people protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, and kind of the list goes on. It's really ramped up. But it was more of a personal fire. And fortunately, I was connected with City Lights, who has a history of taking on people like Allen Ginsberg with Howell when it was on obscenity trial. And, you know, they were up for potential repercussions. And so it was a great fit. But in the meantime, you know, City Lights is a small house. It's a literary house. They don't have money for a big advance, so it was either quit my job or to call my parents to move back home or something, or figure it out. And so if there's one thing to kind of take away from that, it's your situation's not going to be the same, but there's probably a lot of echoes to what you all are dealing with, and you just have to have that fire. I mean, even if you have a great advance, a six-figure advance, it's still a big undertaking.
Just when it comes to carving out time, sort of the sort of sacred time when nobody can bother you or you shut off everything and do it, I think that's some of the best advice I ever got. There's a great essay by Chuck Wendig titled "How to Finish That Fucking Book, You Monster." Very good. It's just got like it's a 30-point sort of approach to it. When it comes to procrastination, I feel like I'm probably the most qualified person in the room to speak about that. I was very, very dogged by it. And in the end, you got to do this thing. And it is a very complex project that doesn't have to be done tomorrow, you know, the next day. So it sort of turns the whole deadline pressure thing on its ear. In a sense, it's way worse. In a sense, it's way better. And the fact that it's way better works against you in the end in terms of, you know, these deadlines sneaking up on you. I think I had 18 months, and I think it took 2.5 years. Anybody else want to speak on that?
Well, I can just tell you that I would bet you that I'm a bigger procrastinator than you are. When you're working.
How can we test this?
We'll never get around to it.
Give it some
time.
Maybe later.
You're like,
when you're working on a collaboration, you're putting all of these pieces together, and I didn't want to write my piece until all the rest of the pieces were in, so it was like herding sheep to make everybody else meet their deadline before I finally got to mine, which I kept putting off because I just kept putting it off. I also worked full-time. I did not take any time off, so like Will said, I could not stop working, so I just didn't sleep in 2017.
It's funny that, like, I'm not sure I'd classify myself as a procrastinator, but it took me probably 10 times longer than all of you to write this book, and I probably wrote 10 words and deleted 9 of them, and so I didn't know how I wanted to write the book, and I think I spent a couple of years. In retrospect, I can say things like I was honing my voice, and I was you know, fleshing out my narrative. But and if it's a book length thing, then, you know, like, that can take some time. But I think in reality I'd procrastinate because I wasn't quite sure how I wanted to flesh out that voice, and I knew that I wanted to tell a story of climate change in a completely different way than I'd ever worked before and that I'd ever seen other people work before. And how do you do that? And eventually I took, the diplomatic way to say it is, I took some time off from my job, 5 months, but I actually quit because they wouldn't let me do that. And then they hired me back. So that's nice, but so it's kind of like a sabbatical, but with absolutely no guarantees that you'll ever work again. And I wouldn't recommend that in retrospect, but it did give me that creative space. This is a panel about things we do not recommend. It did give me that creative space to think differently, and I wasn't sure how to do that when my day job was all about writing and illustrating and editing more typical nonfiction work. And so I didn't, or typical? I don't know if there's typical, but yeah. The boring variety of nonfiction work. And so I needed some time away from that and the creative space to come up with that voice. And once I did, working again and having evenings and weekends and vacation time as writing time, yeah, that worked out. But during that phase where I wasn't quite sure how to tell the story and what my voice was like in this story, it took me a long time to get there. A long time of doing nothing.
Yeah, and what about money is another thing. Typically you'll get a third of your advance on signing, another third when a sort of acceptable first draft comes in, then the final third on publication. I used my first third to pay off debts, and then spent most of the book writing process incurring more debt. And you know, just if you're a freelancer, you're never really caught up financially. Rachel, you were freelance going into it, right?
Yes, for sure. And don't forget the 15% of your advance that goes to your agent, right, and the 30% that goes to taxes. So you're not really left with a lot. So I thought I could freelance while I was doing this book and pay for it that way, which turned out to not be the case. About a little less than a year in, I had written like 2 or 3 chapters, and it was supposed to be due in 2 or 3 months. So I got an extension, but I also just took off the next May to September to write the book. But meanwhile, I had also been paying for myself to fly all over the world to report it. Reporting was in a dozen countries. And then I stopped freelancing. So I had this debt. I wasn't getting any money. I was just going through my savings account. Luckily, I have a husband who paid my half of the rent for those 5 or 6 months. But it was really tough. I mean, I think I had like $3,000 left in my bank account, which was drastically reduced by the end of it. And I calculated last year, and I took a 55% pay cut. So it was really severe, and I understand that not everybody is that privileged and has those resources tucked away.
Yeah. Will, you were dying to say something when I turned it over to Rachel.
It's kind of related to both the Rachel and the other previous comments of both the delays and the financial element. And I would encourage folks that if that's a limiting factor, and it certainly was for me, you don't have to play by the rules. You don't have to just rely on that advance. I mean, a lot of how I've approached everything in my journalism, but with the book in particular, I got into, I mean, the two biggest influences on my life, I think, have been journalism and finding punk rock when I was younger, and a mantra. There is a connection, I promise, and it's this kind of DIY ethic of you don't need to wait for permission. If you can think of partnerships with organizations, you can take on, do freelance bits, which is part of what I did as you're writing in pieces. You can, figure out other financial options. And I think now, we're talking to a room of journalists that have had to be creative in these ways already in our craft, right? And so I think you have to bring that to the publishing as well. I mean, even though nonfiction is doing well and royalties are going up and, advances are going up, it's still, at the end of the day, it's a gamble. And so, you either have to be obsessive about it and commit to the idea, or it might not happen. DIY or die.
I feel like we're talking a lot about the hardships. Did anyone have a moment when you said, oh, this is the funnest thing I've ever done? Let's hear it.
I feel like it's my turn.
Go, Anna.
I mean, like, I can do that.
Unless you can't talk about it.
Seriously, you guys, sometimes, like, I mean, I'm still just kind of coming out of it. It just came out a couple months ago. And in so many ways, it's just a blur. It feels like I dreamed the last, like, couple years. I mean, because my life changed so radically. Like, I mean, the book and the Knight Wallace Fellowship kind of synced up. So that was very fortunate, and that helped me pay down debt, which made it easier to go, once the fellowship was over, to go have a little bit more leeway with my income while I was, like, focusing on it. But it's super hard. I relate to the, as somebody who's sort of trained in deadlines, when you have this, like, longer stretch, it can be challenging to cultivate this different kind of discipline, even when you are really passionate about it, because you're just feeling your way out through telling a story in a different way. It's just different than an article. People told me a lot that it was, to just think of it as a series of magazine articles. But at least for me, that concept didn't quite work, and while that's challenging, it is actually kind of amazing and fun, because you're digging your hands into this, like, whole new creative genre, and it's probably, if I can guess, the medium that we fell in love with first, as writers, we read articles before we read newspapers, read books, first, and then, like, and so, and so it's exciting to kind of be on that end of it. And one of my, like, how I dealt with the procrastination feeling that ended up bringing a lot of joy in my life and is still with me was, I was in that time where, it's just like hardcore writing, and I can't do anything else, and more stuff was happening with the Flint story, but I'm like, I gotta do this part, And I, and one thing that helped was reading short fiction. short stories and short novels, very purposely. I've never picked, I love all kinds of fiction, but I never really picked my next read based on length. But I was doing that, and that was perfect because it gave me this immersive world to go into that I could finish in one sitting or 2 days or 3 days tops. And so it, just finishing books that quickly gave me this sense of productivity and propulsion that I really needed when I was in this like last, you know, with that like middle quarter, you know, like not the, I can't quite see the finish line. I'm more than halfway. I'm in that like, it's like being at mile 20 in a marathon. You still have a, like a decent ways to go, but you've already done so much and you're so tired. And reading like short novels was great. It was like fun and got me excited again at about like just the form and language. And I was finishing them. I was like that, like this, that. And then I'd sit down and write and I have some of that energy I could bring to the page. And that was great. And anyway, I'm still kind of on that right now, even though the book's done, just because it's, I've been reading good things and I want to keep doing that.
It would be unfair to my joy to not talk about a couple of things. When the publisher called to say that the cover was ready, and I went to the meeting, and I saw the cover of the book and cried, not just because the artist truly captured what was necessary, but because it had my name on the front.
Aww.
And, you know, when you see something like that, it really makes it real, and it makes all of that work worthwhile. But the second one was when the blurbs came in, and the one from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was one of the best things that could ever happen in my life. So every now and again, just, you know, in my house, just by myself, I'll just read it out loud. And then the other thing, of course, is I've done almost 60 of these conversations about the book around the country, and each one of those, and they've all been diverse audiences, has been eye-opening, and that's been kind of fun. So when you said fun, that threw me off a little, but it really is a kind of joy to have this to happen, because if I don't do another thing, I have a book. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm working on another one, but this one exists, and it's there. So,
what about you, Lisa?
Well, I guess I agree with the cover sentiment. I just broke down entirely, and I was I was at a science conference. I was looking at my phone, and I saw the cover. And you know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the sciences, but breaking down in tears in the middle of a science conference was kind of a new thing for a lot of people. So you know, but I expanded their horizons, and we all learned about tears. But yeah, so I totally agree, and I was very scared because I'm also an illustrator, and I was like, I have no say over the cover. What are you talking about? Like that really scared me, and the specific title. I had no say over the specific title, although I lobbied hard. But I saw the cover, and I just thought, how did this illustrator get it? Like, did they read the book? Yeah, like, how? You know, it just really, well, here's the cover. Exhibit A. So I had lobbied hard to not have a picture of the Earth from space on another climate book because I was so, in fact, there's a section in the book that is essentially to the editor that says, when you look at the Earth from space, you are disassociated from the planet. You can't see yourself on there. Your feet are on the ground somewhere in there. It's like a giant selfie, but like, it, you know, you don't see yourself. It's completely abstract. And apparently they read that section. So, it, you know, they have this like beautiful, happy sky and everything, but it's a topsy-turvy world, and there's a little girl upside down with a balloon, and it's kind of creepy too. So I really like that moment was fantastic. But way before all of that, in fact, I think before the book contract, I realized that I really like this, and in part because my whole day job history has been writing things that are kind of programmed by others and you know, with limited kind of flexibility in the direction I go. And suddenly I was writing essays, and I was putting myself in the first person in the essays, and I was your narrator, your guide for this whole thing. And that means that I could take you wherever I wanted. And that, more than anything, was like, I took the readers on places that didn't wind up in the book, but like, you know, I got to learn and I got to explore, and I that is totally invaluable.
Yeah.
Let's talk about knowing where to end a book. I mean, I wrote a book that's very much a narrative, and the protagonist, if you will, hasn't died when I was writing it, although his parents thought he might. And so, you know, he's going on with his life. Where do you end it? Do you end it at the moment of triumph, or it turned out to be sort of a false climax? And in my case, is it turned out to be a book about this very eccentric family, not really about the kid himself, but about so much about the parents and how they handled this extreme challenge of helping their kid succeed by doing pretty much the opposite of what most of us do as parents, which is keep their kid away from things that'll kill them. And it just got really interesting, and it seemed like, oh yeah, that, you know, this thing just keeps has a life of its own, it keeps going, but yet I've got to figure out a way to stop this book and have an endpoint that's satisfying narratively. Maybe Anna, you could talk about that, because I think yours is just super narrative, and this obviously, this what you've covered is still going.
Yeah, another one of my procrastination techniques, I guess, was that like I could just endlessly report it because it's still happening, right? Like I think a lot of people, you know, have a template for, like, especially an environmental story, you know, where, you know, there's, you know, this, like, people are hurt, there's some kind of revelation, there's, like, pushback, and at the end there's some, you know, triumphant lawsuit or something like that, put them in jail, or I don't know, there's some ending. And we don't really know what's going to happen in a lot of ways with this still. It was very much a dynamic story, and I knew from the very beginning that was going to be a challenge, because really we're not going to know what the ending, quote unquote, of this story is for years and years, you know. So it was in the back of my mind for a long time that I was going to have to figure out some way to end this that wasn't completely determined by, for lack of a better word, plot, you know, the chain of events, the chronology. And so what I tried to do, like, was to get at this, to kind of return back to this, you know, well, two different things. Like, one, you know, to kind of underscore how part of the legacy of what happened in Flint is this, like, ambiguity, how much is unknown, how much is mysterious, how much people will never know, how the memory of, like, this will impact the future, how the memory of the past of what's happened to the city is impacted, specifically the water crisis. And I also returned to a community that opened the book, you know, like, to put it back on the ground, you know, like, I spent some time with a community in the Civic Park neighborhood in North Flint that's, like, really reimagining what an inclusive neighborhood can be. It's such an interesting neighborhood. It was built by General Motors for their workers, but their white auto workers. It was one of one very segregated community, and it's been very hard hit by vacancy and poverty and so on, and there's this wonderful group of people kind of centered around the Joy Tabernacle Church, which is in the former Presbyterian church that has been, you know, within the remains of this, you know, a neighborhood. They're you know, creating a whole new model for what a city life can be, you know, one that, unlike the past in that specific neighborhood, is inclusive and has room for all, and is centered on, like, helping people be well. You know, they're turning vacant houses into, you know, like a wellness home or an agriculture home, you know, where you can garden on the vacant lot and learn canning inside, and they're, you know, they're apprenticing things. Anyway, the point is I wanted to, like, not just return back to the people that opened the book, but also kind of, like, leave on this, like, template of, you know, that we do have choices about how we make our cities, and while we are dealing with a lot of the baggage of the past, we have actual choices, and in fact, people are doing it literally right now, and showing us what our alternatives are, and if we want to do right by Flint, and we want to do right by our other cities, we can learn from that, you know, we can look to that, and so that's kind of where... Spoiler, that's where it ends. even though, but, like, while trying to be, like, honest about also what I didn't want to be pat and suggest how I think things might end with Flint and the water crisis and the criminal trials and all that. I wanted to kind of, like, keep it back you know, with the people and be honest about what's unknown and just be okay with that ambiguity because that's just what's true.
Okay, so now we've finished the book, it's out, and authors didn't used to have to get that involved in marketing except for showing up at the book signings, things like that. That's obviously changed a whole lot, and people's experiences seem to be really all over the map in terms of what they did with marketing and what they took on themselves and what they left up to the publisher, publicist. So who would like to talk about that? Will, go for it.
I approached it, again, with that kind of DIY. I think it was my publicist nightmare in a way because I was like, and this, and what about we do this, and how about we go on tour, and all these things. And I say that because the life of the book doesn't stop with the actual publishing. You know, there's a lot of ways to think about this. I viewed it in part as wanting to publish this book as a tool for social change, and this is one tool among many. And so that other aspects can do, you know, a media push, you can do radio interviews, you can put out your own video materials, your own, you know, use your own platforms, but also, again, to kind of think creative. It opens up other opportunities. There's this weird thing of, in people's perception of, oh, you wrote a book, you are the expert on this thing, and it's not entirely true. I mean, we hope it's a little bit true, but you can take that as far as you want. I mean, for me, some of the most impactful things this has led to, I gave a talk last year at the European Union about civil liberties, human rights, the rise of, you know, I would say fascism in the United States. And that was not an anticipated outcome, but it's this kind of, I guess what I'm trying to say is a willingness to follow the lead of your own book once it's out in the world, to not just give up on it and move on to the other thing or to expect other people to do your work for you. I mean, you have to use it as part of a platform. This is a platform for you. It's a platform for a second book. It's a platform for a TV show or a film, or just for you to be more kind of a defining voice speaking out on, you know, these are all social justice rooted themes. And I think you have to run with that.
It's possible to say it now, although I would have laughed if anybody had suggested I'd say this before, but the book was easy compared to everything that comes after. Not just the marketing and promotion, but you become the book, which means it's everything you do. You have to talk about it all the time. If you're not someone who's used to talking about themselves or pushing yourself, you have to get out of your comfort zone and be able to do that. If you follow me on Twitter, that's my Twitter cover. It's my Facebook cover. It's what I push out on Instagram. And because I was blessed to work with Wayne State University Press, they're really great, but they're a small press, which means out of the 60 or so appearances I've had, I probably arranged 50 of them. And a lot of those have been because people either saw something that I tweeted or saw somebody say they liked the book and they said, oh, we'd like you to come. Well, the press doesn't have a huge budget to send you to these places, which means you have to negotiate somebody, you know, well, can you fly me in? And if you can't, do you go anyway? And of course you go anyway because you want the book out there. But a lot of it has been, again, I was also blessed to be a columnist. So they did a story in the newspaper, which got a lot of play. And I have a lot of journalist friends who, you know, are keeping up with what's going on. And I'm hoping that some of them will write about it. But you become the book. You have to be really serious about understanding that writing the book is 50% of the job and selling it is the other 50%.
I'm curious because Rochelle, you have a lot of other contributors to your book too, and can you talk a little bit about like how that responsibility of getting the book out there is shared or not shared with the folks who you brought in to the?
I'm glad you asked because you really learn who your friends are. No. There's a wide diversity of people in the book, and some of them have been amazing in going on joint appearances. And I can also tell you that some of it is timing. The book came out in February, so Black History Month was really busy. But for the kickoff of this, we did something at the African American Museum in Detroit. and Leonard Pitts and Nicole Hannah-Jones flew in for it, and it became a whole evening with 300 people, and 200 people stood in line for the book to be signed. So I cried again. I never cry at anything. People sort of know that I'm kind of a non-crier. But to see people line up like that to get the books was amazing. But for several of these appearances, when I was in Indianapolis, Alelia Bundles, who was from Indianapolis, her great-grandmother was the first black female millionaire in America, did it with hair products. Everybody in Indianapolis knows that family. She flew to Indianapolis and did that appearance with me. Tamara Winfrey Harris, who wrote that wonderful book about how there's nothing wrong with black women, it's called The Sisters Are All Right. She came and did one with me. In every city, I tried to get somebody who was close to there, and some people are so busy that they may not necessarily, you know, have time. So there are still people who contributed to the book who they're thrilled that they're in it, but they haven't done anything else since, which is fine, you know, because, again, my name. So my responsibility. But that's a part of, you know, all of that planning. Like, okay, who can come to this one? Where can we go? Who's going to sell it? All of that stuff. It's just a lot of work, but it's been joyous work.
So a lot of book projects start with a magazine, newspaper story, or something. Okay.
Thanks. Okay. How's that? All right. Yeah, a lot of book projects start with, say, a book or a magazine story or a newspaper story. But sometimes books spin off into other media as well, and I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that. Has anybody had experience with doing, say, either a film or other magazine stories or other things that have come out of that? Who wants to talk about that? Go for it.
It hasn't been a very successful experience, but it has been a learning experience. So I've had a lot of offers, like for our TV shows, for dramatized versions, for, you know, doing stuff with HBO, and it just hasn't ever, you know, there's so many additional hurdles, and this is not my background, so I've really relied on other people's input and guidance, but I don't know what the formula is, you know, and there might not be one. I mean, part of it is, like anything, it's having the right connections or being in the right place at the right time, having the right message at the right time, having their houses, having the right money at the right time. But I think Netflix, well, that didn't work out either, but they're doing some incredible stuff with like kind of like extended documentaries in 5, 6, 7 parts. And I throw that out there as maybe, you know, whatever ideas are in your head, it might not have to be a book. And that's not pushing back on anyone's ability. That's just thinking we're in a different climate right now. I mean, it could be a slim volume with a spinoff. It could be a slim volume with a Netflix-pitched idea. I mean, you got to be creative here. I mean, it doesn't have to just be the book project, although the TV deal would be nice.
I can just quickly tell you that a part of the essay that I wrote includes the search for my great-great-grandfather, who was a slave named Balaam, and I've had several people to say, you need to do something with that, like pull that out and write about finding him in the North Carolina State Archives and the tax records of this man. It's not Roots, because I may never know where, how he got to North Carolina or where that part happened, but I can talk about my very first trip to Africa. I went to Dakar, to Senegal, and it was a gathering of small town mayors from America who were meeting with small town mayors from Gambia and Senegal. And they were just talking to us about, you know, who we were and where we came from. And I was a little, maybe there's 3 times that I've cried, because I was very heartbroken to not be able to say. And this very small in stature, not small guy, but this mayor, he didn't touch me, but I'm going to show you. Make sure I was looking at him. And he said, well, why are you sad? And I said, well, I don't know where I come from. I haven't been able to find my place over here. And he said, you belong to all of us. Okay, that's enough.
Wow. I feel like with what's that?
Where's the vodka?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I both got very lucky and very unlucky in terms of spinoffs. On one hand, 20th Century Fox ended up with the option for the film, and it's in development, and then it got renewed, and it was just, you know, well, that's just way premature, because, I mean, it's a miracle if any movie ever gets made, even when they've got a director and people attached to it. But on the other hand, I got asked to do a lot of essays for just so many publications came to me and said, you know, will you do an essay on, you know, gifted education? Will you do an essay on parenting geniuses and this kind of thing? And I realized after a few months, wow, I'm working my butt off and nobody wants to pay me for these things. They're saying things like, it'll help you promote the book. And you know, just you can just end up totally used by editors. It's like they're waiting for, you know, for the opportunity to, you know, go after you. So let's open it up to questions. We've probably generated a few here. If you feel like saying your name, that'd be great. And also Jay wants to make an announcement about timing.
Before we take questions, you know, we can tour the museum, so we need to give some restrictions here when you're going to be walking around. And here's Erica to give you those.
So no backpacks. We do have lockers available if you want to shut them up and make sure they're all safe. If you have any umbrellas, I don't know, it's kind of rainy outside. And then no drinks or food or beverages. If you have a purse, you can put it in there. But otherwise, your guys are good to go. Thank you.
Okay, who's got a question? There's a couple.
My name's Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist in Ohio. And quite a few years ago, I did a documentary on actually African-American history and Underground Railroad connections in Ohio that led actually to Harper's Ferry. And I've been wanting to write this book for a long time. The thing that stopped me is that as a freelancer, I need some money to get started. I need to be able to travel to Canada and North Carolina, and I need some money to live on. Any ideas about how you can get some grant money together before you've even written the first chapter?
As a freelancer, I can speak to that, but I was unsuccessful. I spent a lot of time applying to grants. I applied to National Geographic Society. You can talk to that guy. You were not there while I was applying, though. I applied to the Sloan Foundation, Googleable. And these were really in-depth grants. I mean, it sucked up probably like 2 weeks of my time, and then they didn't pan out. So eventually I was like, I just have to pull the plug and tap into my savings. And if I didn't have savings, I probably would have floated the debt on my credit card. Yeah, I wish I could be more helpful than that, but
One thing, this isn't what I did for the book precisely, but it's something I think about and just how to support my writing life, you know, as a freelancer as well. As I think there have been, you know, there have been a lot of times where I've taken, you know, part-time jobs that have nothing to do with writing. And it's just, but it helps give me a more sustainable source of income. And if there's something, you know, I think like freelance reporting, even if it's not tied to your passion project, the book you want to do, can, you know, tap out the resources we might otherwise be putting towards that. And if there's some way to take some kind of like, you know, very low key, don't have to worry about it, part-time job to provide some sort of income, like as sometimes, you know, I think we should just do that, you know, like that can keep us grounded in the real world too while we're launching on a big ambitious project.
Get you out of the house too.
I have one other thought.
Seriously.
sorry. I did get a Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting grant, which does not pay for books. They don't do books. But I found a couple feature stories I could do, so they paid for me to go to South Africa and Malawi, and that was a huge help.
I think two things. I had grant funding for other projects that took me to some of the locations I wanted to write about. And so I kind of compartmentalized in my head because these were grant-funded education projects that were taking me to specific locations, but I wanted to write about them creatively in the other half of my head. And so I kind of, you know, if you're going somewhere, I mean, it reduces your carbon footprint to just go there for two projects. And I did that, but then I also, like Anna was saying, I took on some freelance work for the textbook industry, which I'm not proud of, but it does pay really well, and it does not tap the creative side of you, and so it really, it really was not that much work, and I told myself this was all on top of my normal expenses, so it's going into the account that'll, you know, let your creative writing thrive, and so that, I had to, you know, really stop myself from using it to pay down credit card debt and do other things, you know, that needed to be coming from my day job. But that helped me quite a bit, and I guess I wouldn't recommend writing for the textbook industry, but it really did kind of help me be able to go to some of the locations that nothing as exotic as Africa, but it all costs money, and that can be hard.
Hi, I'm Teresa Brain. I'm a freelancer. How do you know when an idea is not a book? Because I worked really hard. I had this whole thing that I was going to do as a book, and someone said, you're not enough of an expert. You need a platform. So then I got a column on a website and wrote it for a year, and that became a platform, and I have 23,000 words. But still, it doesn't seem to quite be, I don't know how to get it into the book. And then I kind of let it go, and now I don't know if its moment has passed, and I also have debt, so I'm kind of like casting about for what to do and whether that's a viable project or do I switch to something else because I have other ideas.
The question I got constantly from agents and just other journalists, others in the craft, was, you know, is this a book or a magazine article? Right, that's what you're going to hear over and over again. And the answer, part of it might be that it starts as a magazine article. It starts as these different sections and builds to that, depending on what your needs are and what you're describing. So that's just something to throw out there as well. I mean, that was a big roadblock in getting my book published with some of the people that were first approaching me. They're like, well, we're not seeing, they wanted, you know, these kind of sexy profiles of underground activists and all these. I'm like, no, this is not the point. You know, we need the big picture. And so part of it, you have to stick to your guns on it, too. If you really think in your gut that you need to tell a long-form story that can only be told book length with your expertise, with themes rather than breaking news, you know, make the case.
I think a question I got a lot too is, like, even though this like Flint thing was like in the spotlight and there was a lot of attention about it, and, you know, so there was this sort of, you know, publishers were having, I was having conversations with a few different publishers, but one of the questions that kept coming up was, you know, will people still care about this in a couple of years? And people who have no connection to Flint or Michigan or the Midwest, you know? And I was irritated about that question because I was like, well, isn't it obvious all these ways why this is, you know, a huge story for its own reasons and also for what it reveals. But and I made that case, but it ended up working with a publisher who did not ask that question because they knew, and we had some mind meld. But I appreciate where they're coming from in the sense of, like, you know, in deciding whether it's a book, you have to think a few, like, will it have resonance a few years from now, and is your audience larger than you know, a specific region or city, you know, like who can you connect with? How is the story going to have meaning to place it, people who are coming cold to your topic?
Okay.
Yeah. Dale Willman from City University of New York and NPR. The reality of publishing now is that a lot of books don't make a lot of money. I hope all of you sell a couple hundred thousand and get movie rights. But what I think I'm hearing this morning is, well, you go into debt to write this book, and then what are you, a successful author with a lot more debt? Or is there something I'm missing here?
No, I mean, that's a great way of laying it out, unfortunately.
Sorry.
It's a tough one. I mean, you're never, one thing that's for sure is you'll never make more than the advance. I mean, unless you got no advance at all. So you go for the as big an advance as you can, obviously. I think there's an intangible that's kind of neat. It's like sort of having an extra big business card that you didn't have before. I mean, people do know you for this book, for better or for worse, that it can also pigeonhole you, I think. You know, but it's kind of cool. You were a person that was just doing whatever stories, sometimes long form, and then you're a guy who has this book, and I think most people understand just how difficult it is to put a book together, so you've got that feather in your cap, I suppose, and you know, that and $2.50 will buy a shot of espresso. Anyone else?
I do want to say that, and for the previous question as well, so much of all of this is personal decisions that you have to make for yourself about who and what you are. As much as I wanted to be an author and as much as I wanted to do this book, I would never quit my day job only because I like to eat. I think now that I've done this and now that I'm really excited about writing and continuing to be an author, I would consider it. But I would go into it knowing that, okay, now I will be somebody who will get a bunch of credit cards or be in debt because I want it that much. But you have to decide. And I didn't answer your question because you got such great answers. But please don't let anybody else tell you what is a book for you, what is important for you. I can tell you that if you're at 23,000 words and you don't see yourself to 70,000, it's not a book. But you have to make that decision. But I think that you have to decide it's worth it. And if you have a day job or if you have a regular freelance gig and you can make both work, I could never do what Rachel did and go around the world and devote myself to that only because she's younger and she's got more energy. And, you know, you really wanted to do that. And I mean, seriously, I love what you did. And that's such an important issue. So I'm so glad you did it. But you got to decide for you. And for me, I had to figure out how I could do this and continue to work, which means I literally really didn't sleep in 2017. And I'm so glad to be sleeping now.
And I would just encourage you to think of it as a long game or long con, depending on your how you're thinking about all this and what we're saying. That I think it gets to a natural point, especially in a journalist's career, that you've been at X number of newsrooms, or you've been at the same newsroom for a long time, you've started to specialize or become known for whatever, and you either need a book project to fulfill what's inside, you know, there's a drive for it, or to show, you know, it's a level of, I don't want to say maturity, but you know what I'm getting at. Like, this is a, for better or worse, there's a weight that comes with it that opens up a lot of opportunities that might not pay off, you know, the expenses in the near term, but I think inevitably pay off long term in the opportunities they raise.
Some of those opportunities also can be speaking opportunities. I don't think we've mentioned that yet, but that can be fairly substantial. And people will call on you if you have a book because you're supposedly an expert. Lynette, you have a question.
It's a question for Rachel.
Wait.
Thanks. Lynette Clementson. It's a question for Rachel, but pulling off of something that Tom said, that sometimes this large business card can be pigeonholing. And journalists often get into the craft because we have lots of different interests and we're restless and we like moving around and and bouncing from thing to thing and learning about lots of different things. And when you do a book that shows a real depth of expertise in one area, how do you move to the next? How do you move to the next thing? And so I guess for all of you to answer, but particularly Rachel, how are you thinking about the next thing you do? What are you being asked to do next? And do you feel pigeonholed at all?
I'm very aware of that, and I want to avoid it. And I also do have an itch to write about things other than wildlife trade, especially now. I've been doing a lot of wildlife trade stuff, especially related to the book, and just because it's so easy now. But I've found that if I just pitch as usual, people aren't like, oh, you can't write about this because you're the wildlife trade person now. Like last week I wrote about octopuses on ecstasy, so there's other work available, yeah.
One thing, kind of related to that question, I definitely relate to like being somebody of many interests, and it's one reason why, for all my gripes about being a freelance writer, it's one thing I've loved about it is, you know, you get that cross-pollinating, you know, experience of the world and as a writer, and it's wonderful. A few things like kind of helped is, one is like, you know, I felt like even though the book is like a sort of in-depth focus on sort of ostensibly one thing, it's often, it's many things. It brings many threads together. At least that's what I was trying to do, to bring, you know, there's, you know, just there's a lot of different narrative threads in there and references and stuff like that. So it feels, even though it's like substantial on one thing, it feels like it was also, you know, I was able to like indulge a lot of different kinds of interests and curiosities. I'm still feeling out what this, like, you know, post-book life is like. I do feel like one, you know, like I want to keep writing about it. It's okay to be pigeonholed a little bit on that because there is a lot still happening, and I still feel curious, and I want to keep knowing what's happening as this story goes forward. But yeah, there's that other dimension of like, well, what's the other thing too? You know, like where do I go next as a writer? I don't know. And having what is the difference between my choices and other people's, you know, kind of expectations or what room there is or isn't for me? One thing I'm trying to do, and not always gracefully am I doing it, but try to be just sort of like patient with like let things sit for a while, you know, let things like kind of incubate for a while, like trust time to a certain extent, I don't know, like that's kind of my point is I don't know, and just be kind of okay with that.
Any other journalists with questions? Okay, we have one more over here.
Hi, I just wanted to say that my name is Sally Randolph, and I'm a guest, and I'm a lawyer. And I wanted to point out, when people were talking both about the post-book world and the pre-book world, if you're considering doing other writing about the same subject for periodicals or for Love or whatever, it's very important in your contracts to make sure if you're writing about something you think might become a book, be careful about your rights that you're granting so that you will have the freedom to do that. And you may have some hard choices to make because many magazines and newspapers won't accept the limitations that you want to. And then within your publishing contract, you need to make sure that you have the right to do magazine articles. And in your agency agreements, you may want to speak to your agent about making sure that they're not going to take 15% of your magazine income or whatever. It's just like a puzzle, the rights. And it's important to think about in context of your entire career.
Yeah, it's an important point. I have some great editors at National Geographic, New York Times, and I talked to them about this when I was getting going and made sure that everything was clear and they were cool with it.
Yeah, that's really a timely point. Magazine contracts especially are getting really weird in terms of the rights grabs that they're trying to get. I'm in negotiation with one right now that, they want right of first review on any projects that are related to the
subject of the story, and they also want to prohibit you from using the material for 1 year after it's killed, if they kill it. It's just insane.
Don't sign it, Tom.
I wanted to mention one other little thing. Oh, I'm sorry.
I can't say what magazine it is, but it has a yellow border. I think there's somebody here from maybe the society.
I didn't use an agent, but I did have a really good attorney. And one of the other things you want to make sure of is every author, no matter whether it's your first book or your 10th book, you want to catch lightning in a bottle and have that one that will be a New York Times bestseller. One of the things that will show up in almost every contract that you have to either negotiate or have taken out is that they want the rights to the next two or three books that you do. Because if you did something great, they want to make sure that they've got you, and you just have to watch out for things like that so that they don't do that.
I have a question for my fellow panelists. I have an arts attorney that I consult whenever I have a contract. Is that what you guys, did you all do that when you got your book contract?
Agents take care of that if you have
agents,
an agent.
Okay. Without an agent, yes, make sure you have an attorney do it.
I used an agent, but I also used lawyers through the Authors Guild. You know, if you're a member of that, I literally signed up for the legal review, you know, and so they can look at it and be like, here's, you know, you might suggest rephrasing it as this, and they specialize in writer issues and rights and all that, and that was very helpful.
Yeah, Michael Gross at the Authors Guild is fantastic. He really has just great ideas on how to negotiate contracts and what to take out if you can. Anybody else? All right. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for sitting through this.
Yeah.
Much appreciated.
Huge thanks.